This is a copyrighted work. Unauthorized copying or distribution is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000.
Scholastic Audio presents Mr. Impossible, The Dreamer Trilogy, Book 2, by Maggie Stiefvater, read by Will Patton. For Melissa. I'm the earth, I'm the water you walk on, I'm the sun and the moon and the stars. Phantogram, Mr. Impossible. Flower guided it was that they came as they ran on something that lay in the shape of a man. Robert Frost, Spoils of the Dead. Oh, the things you can think up if only you try. Dr. Seuss. Oh, the things you can think. Prologue. When they came to kill the Zed, it was a nice day. It was Illinois, probably, or one of those states that start with an I. Indiana, Iowa, Wisconsin. Fields, but not the postcard kind. No picturesque barns, no aesthetically rusted farm equipment, just stubbled field. The sky was very blue. The rubbled end of season wheat fields were very bright and pale. Everything was very clear. It was like an ocean vacation without the ocean. Bisecting the landscape was a highway, very flat, very straight, gray-white, with salt. A single vehicle was visible, a semi-truck with a clean red cab and a trailer that read, Living Solutions, Atlanta, New York, Nashville. These words were accompanied by a black-and-white line drawing of an Edwardian chair, but there were no chairs inside the truck. They were inside it. The moderators. The home team, the winning team, the ones who were working hard every day to keep the end of the world at bay. Or at least, that was what the writing on the tin promised. An assemblage of reasonable adults gathered together to stop a supernatural menace most people were unaware existed. Zeds. Zed, as in Z. As in Z. As in sleep. Which was when Zeds became weapons. Zed, as in zero, as in how much of the world would be left if the moderators didn't step in. Not many noble callings left in the world, but surely this was one. Baos drove the furniture truck, even though he had freshly lost his arm. Ramsey rode in the passenger seat. He was picking his nose and wiping it on the door in an aggressive way, daring Baos to say something. Baos did not. He had other things to think about, like missing his arm. He also thought about the creatures that had torn it off in Declan Lynch's townhome not too long before. Those hounds. Inky black hounds with eyes and mouths of baleful fire. The stuff of myth. What had come first? Had Zeds dreamt the monsters who became the thing of legend? Or had legends inspired the Zeds to make the imaginary reality? Somewhere, he was thinking, those monsters still existed, solid and gas, living and deathless. They followed entirely different rules than humanity, so humanity couldn't defeat them. This was why the Zeds had to die. They were breaking everything. Baos and Ramsey were not alone on this trip. Normally they would have been, but everyone was spooked. They'd never had a Zed get away before. They'd never had two Zeds get away before. They'd never had six Zeds get away and not been able to figure out what the problem was. It was hard not to blame it on the first three who'd gotten away, the ones on the banks of the Potomac. It was time for the big guns. The back of the furniture truck brimmed with more moderators. It really was a nice day. Somewhere up ahead was the Zed's trailer. A supernatural vision had established the general look of where they might find the Zed, and local law enforcement had helped them narrow it down even further. If all was going according to plan, the Airstream was a few dozen yards off the highway up ahead. If all continued going according to plan, in 25 minutes, any large chunks of the Airstream still remaining, plus the Zed's body, would be loaded in the back of the furniture truck. And if the plan truly loved them in a meaningful and lasting way, their visionary would then stop being tormented by all-consuming visions of an end of the world brought about by Zeds.
Approaching the target, Bayo said into his handheld radio. From inside the back of the truck, Locke, their superior, rumbled in his deep voice, "Keep your eyes about you."
"Copy," said Ramsey, although he could have just said okay. Locke's voice came over the radio again.
"Carmen, are you still there?"
The radio crackled, and a clear, professional voice said,
"2 miles back. Would you like us closer?"
This voice belonged to Carmen Farouk Lane, another moderator. She sat behind the wheel of a bullet-ridden rental car, impeccably dressed in a pale linen suit, her dark hair pulled back into a soft updo, her wrists adorned with slender gold threads, her lashes long and curled. In a former life, before her brother had turned out to be both a Zed and a serial killer, Farouk Lane had been a young executive at a financial management company. That life had been shot dead, just like her serial killer Zed brother Nathan. But the apocalypse wasn't going to find her looking as if she had given up.
"Just don't go far," Locke said, "unless you need to."
He didn't mean unless you need to, though. He meant unless Liliana needs to. Liliana, like all visionaries, became a living bomb during her visions. She also changed ages within her timeline during these visions. This latter fact was really more of a novelty item. No one died because Liliana the girl became Liliana the old woman, or vice versa. No, people died because while she was having visions, the insides of their bodies exploded. The other visionaries had learned to turn this energy inward so they didn't kill bystanders, albeit with the drawback that this method eventually killed the visionaries instead. Liliana had not yet learned. Or it was possible she didn't want to.
"All right, folks," Locke said over the radio as they closed in. "Focus. We've done this before. No mistakes this time."
Westerly Reed Hager. Farouk Lane had seen the Zed's photo, had read her file. It was all fives and tens. 55 years old. 5'10". 10 addresses on file for the last 5 years. 5 sisters. 10 brothers, most of them off the record, off the grid, off the planet. An expanded view of a hippie pedigree. She lived in an Airstream trailer she'd owned for 5 years, pulled by a dark blue Chevy pickup truck she'd owned for 10. She had 10 misdemeanors to her name, 5 for bad checks, 5 for criminal mischief. Farouk Lane didn't think Westerly Reed Hager was likely to end the world. "Carmen," said Liliana. She sat in the passenger seat of the bullet-ridden rental car, currently an old woman. Everything about her was held with an easy control, her knobby old hands folded neatly as book pages in her lap. "I would hang back." The rental car's radio switched on by itself. It began to play opera. This was a thing it did now. Just like killing Zeds was a thing Farouk Lane did now. If Farouk Lane thought about it, the apocalypse had already happened, just inside her. Farouk Lane looked at Liliana. Then she looked at the empty road ahead. She hung back. The plan began to break. One moment, the moderators were alone in the nice day, the empty fields, And then it wasn't just them. Somehow, there was another car on the road ahead of them. It didn't just pop into being. It just seemed to have always been there, and they'd not noticed it until then. Baos whispers to no one in particular, "I'm already forgetting I'm seeing it." He was looking right at the strange car, but he wasn't seeing it. He was looking, not seeing, looking, not seeing. He kept telling himself, "There's a car, there's a car, there's a car," and nearly forgetting the truth of it every time. His mind was breaking. The car slowed so the furniture truck was right on its ass. A person appeared, a young woman, dark skin, huge white smile. She was standing up through the strange car's sunroof. It was one of the three Zeds who'd gotten away on the banks of the Potomac. Jordan Hennessy. Oh, shit! Baos swiped for the radio before he realized that the arm he'd swiped with wasn't there anymore. Ramsey grabbed the radio instead, smashed the button on the side. "There's a Zed! It's..." Hennessy gave them the finger before throwing something at their windshield. The two men in the truck's cab had just enough time to see that the projectile was a small silvery orb before it exploded across the windshield. A metallic cloud burst around the truck. The cloud was getting inside the cab. The radio was talking. Locke was talking. None of it seemed important. All that was important was looking at the cloud, watching the little glimmering motes hovering in the air, feeling each sparkly moment invade their nostrils, coat their sinuses, live in their minds. They were the cloud. The truck hurtled off the highway, just missing the Airstream trailer. It churned several dozen yards into the dead wheat before coming to a lumpy halt. "What's going on?" shouted the radio. No one answered. Now the back of the truck was opening. The other moderators were coming out, guns bristling. To this point, guns had always won. Well, aside from the last time. And the time before that. And the one before that. And before that. But before that, it had been moderators 200 Z0 or whatever. The point was that statistically the guns would work.
"Stay sharp," Locke said.
A few yards away between the truck and the Airstream, a car door opened. This shocked the emerging moderators, who, like Baos and Ramsey, found it difficult to remember seeing the strange car. A young man stepped out. He had dark, buzzed hair and pale, chilly skin. His eyes were as blue as the sky above, though more suggestive of bad weather. The young man was taking something from his jacket, a little glass bottle with a dropper top. He was uncapping it. He was another one of them. Ronan Lynch.
"Oh, shit," said a moderator named Nikolenko.
Ronan Lynch squeezed drops of liquid onto the flattened wheat, and every drop released wind, fury, leaves. It was an East Coast winter squall contained in a bottle. Impossible. Dreamt. Mind-bending. It churned moderators from their feet and sent bullets wide. It pummeled their bodies and thoughts. It was not just weather, but also the feel of weather, the dread of it, the damp, pressed-down sloth of a socked-in late-year storm, and they couldn't rise as it soaked them. From the open door of the Airstream, Westerly Reed Hager watched Ronan walk among the stunned moderators, kicking the guns from their hands, his clouds shifting and ebbing around him. The irascible storm from the eyedropper didn't bother him. He was just another piece of it. Hennessy also stalked among the not-quite-awake, not-quite-asleep bodies. Kneeling swiftly, she picked up one of the abandoned guns. Then just as quick, she put the weapon to its fallen owner's temple. The moderator didn't react. He was dazzled by dreams. She put it to his cheek instead, pressed the barrel into his skin hard enough to pull his mouth up in a weird smile. The man's eyes were misted, confused. Ronan looked at the gun, and then he looked at Hennessy. It seemed obvious she was about to blow the man's brains out. It was unclear whether or not the man was one of the moderators who had killed her entire family. It was clear, however, that this nuance didn't matter to her. Hennessy. This voice came from the third Zed who'd arrived in the strange car. He was a dapper blonde with close-set hawkish eyes and an expression that suggested he knew what the world was thinking and didn't care for it. Bride.
Hennessy?
He said again. The gun seemed to get larger in her hand the longer it was pressed to the man's head. This was no dream magic. This was just the magic of violence. It was a sustainable form of energy, violence. It powered itself. Hennessy's hand shook with fury. I get to do this. I already paid the admission for this ride.
Hennessy, Bride said a third time. Hennessy's words were flippant, although her voice was electric. You are not my real dad. There are better ways to do that. Ways to make it matter more. Do you think I don't know what you want?
A ripple of tension. Then Hennessy put the gun down.
Let's finish this, Bride said.
The moderators watched them, dazed, motionless, ill with longing and dread as the Zeds made their way to Locke. Bride nodded a confirmation to Ronan and Hennessy. The two of them crouched before slipping on small black fabric sleeping masks. For the briefest of moments, they were blind bandits, and then a second later, they both slumped to the ground in fast sleep.
The Zed in the Airstream trailer, watching with wide, shocked eyes, shouted, "Who are you?"
A Bride put his fingers to his lips. Hennessy and Ronan dreamt. When they woke, just a few minutes later, a dead body lay beside Hennessy. Forger in life, forger in sleep. The corpse was identical in every way to the living body already lying in the dirt. She had dreamt a perfect copy of Locke. She was also temporarily paralyzed, as all Zeds were after dreaming something into being, so Ronan heaved her up in a fireman's hold and carried her back to the hard-to-see car. After they had gone, Bride rolled the real Locke onto his side so he could face his copied body, so he could see the perfection of it and be horrified. Bride crouched between the two Locks, a lithe, nimble Renard beside Locke's blunt power. "This game of yours," Bride began, and there was no softness to his voice, "will only end in pain. Take a look. The rules are changing. Do you understand? Do you understand what we could do? Leave my dreamers alone."
There was no change in the living Locke's expression. Bride reached into Locke's pocket and took out a small parcel. Now Locke's eyes swam into focus long enough to show real panic, but his fingers could only snatch limply, drugged by Ronan Lynch's dreamt storm.
"This is mine now," Bride whispered, hiding away the parcel. His teeth were a fox's little snarl. "The trees know your secrets."
Locke's mouth opened and closed. Bride stood. He stopped by the Airstream trailer where the spared Zed was talking with Ronan, and then they all drove away. The car in one direction, the trailer in another, leaving behind a catastrophe of moderators scattered across the stubbled wheat. Slowly, the dreamt weather dissolved, and the fields returned to their previous featureless peace. It was as if the Zeds had never been there at all. Far back from the others, from the safety of where they'd watched this all unfold, Farouk Lane turned to Liliana and said, "Those three could end the world."
1. Ronan Lynch still remembered the worst dream he'd ever had. It was an old dream now, 2 years old. 3? 4? As a kid, time had been slippery, and now, as an adult, or as a whatever he was downright slimy. It had happened before. That was all that mattered. Ronan used to divide his life into the time before his father's death and the time after it, but now he divided it differently. Now it was before he'd been good at dreaming, and after. This was before. When the worst dream showed up,
Ronan already had a vibrant catalog of memorable nightmares. What sort did you want? Perhaps the classic monster mash? Talons, fangs, shaggy feathers dripping with rain? Public humiliation? In a movie theater trying to hide a runny nose, wiping endless snot on a ratty sleeve? Body horror? Scissors slipping and snipping right into an arm, the bone and tendon sliding free? Mind fuckery was a perennial choice, entering a familiar room and being struck with a sense of hideous and unshakable wrongness that dug and dug and dug inside him until he awoke shaking and covered in sweat. He had them all.
Nightmares are lessons, his mother Aurora had told him once. They feel wrong because you know what's right.
Nightmares are bitches, his father Neil had told him once. Let them smile at you, boy, but do not get their number.
Nightmares are chemical, his boyfriend Adam had told him once. Inappropriate adrenaline response to stimulus, possibly related to trauma.
Talk dirty to me, Ronan had replied. Here's what nightmares were. Real. At least for him. Everyone else woke up with cold sweats and a racing heart, but if Ronan wasn't careful, he woke up with everything he'd been dreaming of. It used to happen a lot. And it was starting to happen a lot again. He was starting to think maybe before and after weren't as clearly defined as he'd thought. This was what happened in the worst dream. Ronan turned on a light and saw a mirror. He was in the mirror. The Ronan in the mirror said to him, Ronan? He woke with a start in his old bedroom at the Barnes, spine sweaty, hands tingling, heart kicking at his ribs, usual nightmare post-game. The moon wasn't visible, but he felt her looking in, casting shadows behind rigid desk legs and above the stretching wings of the ceiling fan. The house was silent, the rest of the family asleep. He got up and filled a glass with water from the tap in the bathroom. He drank it, filled another one. Ronan turned on the bathroom light and saw the mirror. He was in the mirror. The Ronan in the mirror said to him, Ronan. And he twitched awake again, this time for real. Ordinarily, when one woke, it was obvious the dream was a pretender. But this time, dreaming about dreaming, it had felt so real. The floorboards, the cold chipped tiles of the bathroom, the sputter of the tap. This time, when he got up for that glass of water, the real glass, the waking glass, he was sure to marvel his fingertips over everything he passed, reminding himself of how specific waking reality was. The bumpy plaster walls, the rubbed smooth curve of the chair rail molding, the puff of air from behind Matthew's door as he pushed it open to see his younger brother sleeping. You're awake. You're awake. This time, in the bathroom, he paid attention to the moon slatted through the blinds, the faded copper stain around the base of the old faucet. These were details, he thought, the sleeping brain couldn't invent. Ronan turned on the bathroom light and saw the mirror. He was in the mirror. The Ronan in the mirror said to him, Ronan? And then he woke in his bed again. 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 Shit. He gasped for air like a dying thing. Ronan couldn't tell if he was awake or if he was dreaming, and he no longer knew how to interrogate the difference. He examined every part of both dream and waking and felt no seam between them. He thought, I might be doing this forever, trying to wake, never knowing if he had succeeded. Sometimes he wondered if he was still in that dream. Maybe he had never woken at all. Maybe every possible thing that had happened since that Ronan in the mirror, all the outrageous events of his high school years, good and bad, had been in his head. It was as plausible an explanation as any. The worst dream. Before, he thought he'd always know the difference between dream and waking, what was real and what he'd invented, but after. Wake up, white boy. We're here, Hennessy said. Ronan woke as the car pulled to a stop, tires crunching gravel, brush scratching the exterior. He had been stretched in the back seat. Now he sat up, pressing the heel of his hand to the crick in his neck. On the other side of the back seat, Chainsaw, his dreamt raven, scrabbled inside her box, sensing they were about to get out. Automatically, he reached for his phone to check for texts before remembering it was gone. Outside, the cold afternoon had turned to a warm, golden evening. Flat-roofed buildings huddled around a commercial parking lot, the gutters gilded fondly by the late-day light. It was a sort of complex that looked as if it ought to have school buses parked in front of it, and sure enough, Ronan spotted a faded sign, West Virginia Museum of Living History. An unhindered tree of heaven grew around the sign, and tributaries of overgrown cracks ran through the parking lot. End-of-season leaves curled auburn and purple wherever the breeze couldn't reach. The Museum of Living History looked like it had been dead for decades. Just the kind of place Bride usually brought them. In the weeks since they'd fled from the moderators on the bank of the Potomac, Bride had directed them to collapsed houses, empty vacation rentals, shuttered antique stores, vacant airport hangars, disused hiking shelters. Ronan couldn't tell if Bride's preference for the decrepit was grounded in secrecy or aesthetic. It felt like secret didn't have to be synonymous with abandoned, but Bride nevertheless brought them to places that few human hands had touched in recent memory. These lodgings always lacked creature comforts, but Ronan couldn't complain. The three of them were alive, weren't they? Three dreamers, wanted by the law, still standing, bristling with piss and vinegar as they climbed out of their dreamt car. Bride said, "Listen, what do you hear?" He said this every time they got someplace new. Ronan heard the dry hiss of the wind through trapped leaves, the distant roar of trucks on the highway, the murmur of an unseen airplane, a dog barking. Some kind of buzzing generator far away. The soft whoosh of Chainsaw's wings. Watching the black-feathered bird rise above the three of them in a strange, warm place filled him with a feeling he couldn't describe. One he'd been feeling more and more since they'd fled. It was like a fullness. A presence. A realness. Before, he had been hollow, drained. No, draining, becoming empty, and now there was something inside him again. "Listen," Bride said, and Ronan listened. What did he hear? His pulse in his ears? The stir of his blood? The movement of his soul? The hum of the thing that was filling him? It couldn't be happiness, he thought. Because he was far from his brothers and from Adam. He worried about them, and surely he couldn't be happy if he was worried. But it felt a lot like happiness. When the last human dies, there will still manage to be a plane whining over the empty forest, Bride said. Although he was complaining, his voice remained measured. He was, in most ways, the polar opposite of his mercurial pupils. Nothing startled him nor sent him flying off the handle. He did not laugh hysterically or burst into rageful tears. He did not swagger or self-abase, indulge or self-abnegate. He simply was. Everything about his posture announced him not as an apex predator, but rather as something powerful enough that he could opt out of the predator-prey scenario entirely. All of this without a tousled lock of tawny hair out of place. He's sort of a dandy, Hennessy had said to Ronan privately on the first day. Like a super dandy. He beat all the other dandies, and now he's the boss dandy, the one you have to defeat to get that button-down shirt of his. Ronan didn't like the word dandy, but he understood what she was trying to say. There was something light and insubstantial about Bride, something dissonant with the weight of his purpose. Ever since he'd met Bride in person, Ronan had thought there was something surprising about him. A mismatch. A weird join-up of the wires in Ronan's brain, like he was thinking of one word but saying another. It meant that every time Ronan looked at Bride for long, it felt as if a shapeless question formed in Ronan's mouth. But what could the question be? The answer was always just, Bride. Bride asked,
What do you feel?
Hennessy launched into a dynamite monologue. She was a tape that had always been playing fast, and since they'd gone on the run, she'd shifted into fast forward. Feel. What do I feel? I feel West Virginia. You might be forgiven for thinking you feel Virginia. It's close, so close, but it's got a bit more of the leather perfume to it. I'm tasting... What am I tasting? I'm getting a bit of a banjo mouthfeel. No, dulcimer. That's the one. I knew there were strings involved. Something else is coming through. Is it kudzu? Hold on, let me let it breathe. Is that a note of sulfur?
Hennessy couldn't be stopped mid-swing, so Bride waited ruefully, and Ronan got his bag and his sword with the words Vexed Nightmare on the hilt. He slung both over his back, adjusting the scabbard so that the blade hung neatly between his shoulder blades. He wasn't going to bother with this particular game of Bride's anyway. He already knew it was one he couldn't win. When Bride asked, What do you feel? What he meant was, How much lay power can you feel? And Ronan had never been able to feel the power of the invisible ley lines that fueled his dreams. At least not while he was awake. Adam could. If Ronan and Hennessy hadn't ditched their phones on the first night to keep the moderators from using them as tracking devices, Ronan could have texted him for some tips. Well, maybe. By the time they ditched their phones, Adam still hadn't answered Ronan's last text. Tamquam, Ronan had messaged, which was always supposed to be answered by Alter Edom. But Adam hadn't replied at all. The silence sort of made this... The being away, easier.
What do you feel?
Confused.
If you're finished, Bright said dryly, the ley line, what do you feel?
There's some, Hennessy guessed. Bigger than a bread box, smaller than a lawnmower, enough for Ronan Lynch to make a mess later.
Ronan flipped her a lazy bird.
Flip your senses, not your fingers, Ronan, Bride told him. This division between your waking and sleeping selves is artificial, and I promise you one day soon the space between them will not bring you joy. Get your things, Hennessy. We're here for the night.
Just what I was hoping you'd say.
Hennessy groped around like a zombie.
I've lost Burrito. Ronan Lynch, tell me if I'm getting warm. Oof, never mind.
Burrito, the car, wasn't truly invisible because Bride had cautioned against dreaming true invisibility. He didn't like them to dream anything that was permanent, infinite, repeating, impossible to undo. He didn't like any creation that left an invulnerable carbon footprint after its maker was gone. So the car wasn't invisible. It was simply ignorable. Ronan was pretty proud of it. Bride had specifically asked him for a discreet vehicle and clearly had no doubts Ronan could deliver. It had felt good to be needed, trusted. He wished the process of dreaming it into being had gone a little bit more elegantly, but win some, lose some. As Hennessy shouldered on a sword that matched Ronan's, apart from having a hilt that read, From Chaos, Ronan called up, Chainsaw, we're going in! The raven tunneled down through the air to him. Ronan turned his head just in time to keep from getting a face full of talons as she landed on his shoulder. Bride pushed open the door to the museum.
Was it locked? Hennessy asked.
Was it? Bride replied. After you.
Inside, the West Virginia Museum of Living History was unkempt and unintentionally hilarious. Cluttered, dim hallways led them past room upon room of life-size dioramas with vintage props and faded mannequins.
Here, students in overalls and or pigtails gave rapt attention to a mannequin teacher in an old-fashioned schoolroom. There, a sturdy doctor examined a less sturdy patient in a field hospital. Here, women's rights activists lobbied for votes. There, miners descended into a concrete cave mouth. The mannequins' faces were cartoonishly simple. It all smelled, even above and beyond what one would expect from a building abandoned since the 1970s. Ronan said, "This place is looking at me. What is that reek?"
The West Virginia Museum of Living History provides an immersive experience through sight, sound, and smell. Hennessy had found a brochure and she narrated it as she stepped around boxes and furniture pulled out into the hall. Over 500 unique scents are piped into diverse scenarios. Students fall back through time in a one-of-a-kind outing they're sure to remember.
"Give me a hand," said Bride. He had already dragged two mannequins into the hall and was going back for a third. He stood them shoulder to shoulder in the hall. He didn't have to explain what he was doing. In the dim light, the mannequins looked convincingly and confusingly vital, at least enough to give an intruder pause. A sham army. Ronan was beginning to understand that Bride's first instinct was always to play with his enemies' heads. He would fight if he must, but he always preferred having his opponents defeat themselves. "You just going to stand there?" Ronan asked Hennessy as he and Bride dragged out a snazzy executive in a three-piece suit, a wartime housewife in a flower dress, and three cadets in dusty uniforms.
"I can't touch bad art,"
Hennessy gestured to a sailor with unevenly painted eyes. "It will rub off on me."
"What a way to lose my powers."
Without malice, Bride observed, "If I had the same policy about dreamers, you wouldn't be here." Ronan made a sizzling sound as he touched the train conductor's cheek. That burned so hot this guy's face melted. In fact,
"The West Virginia Museum of Living History is also,"
Hennessy raised her voice to drown Ronan out, the brochure held in front of her face,
"available for overnight birthday parties and weekend home school outings. Discounts available for groups over three. Shit. If only we had one more dreamer, the money we would save. We could put it toward Ronan Lynch's college fund."
"Not for going to college, for when he burns one down and insurance doesn't cover it."
"Bride, love, any chance we can pick up a hitchhiker? Another dreamer who will fail you less than I for a family fun pack?"
Bride stepped away from the mannequins, dusting off his hands. "Do you want another?" Ronan didn't care to think about this. It gave him the same vibe he used to get back at the barn some nights when he got trapped in one particular train of thought, where he imagined he and Adam had been together a very long time, and then Ronan died of old age or bad choices, and Adam found someone else, and later they all three were reunited in the afterlife, and rather than getting to spend the rest of eternity together, Adam had to split his time between Ronan and a stupid usurper he'd fallen in love with as a widower, which completely ruined the point of heaven. And that was before Ronan even got to worrying if Adam made it to the afterlife at all with his agnostic tendencies. "Three's a good number," Ronan growled, shooting Hennessy a dark look as they headed deeper into the museum. "Burrito's built for three."
"You can fit two more people in the back seat," Hennessy said.
"Not if the person in the back seat's lying down."
"Good point. If you're spooning, you could probably stack four or five people back there. Two more in the trunk."
"Dreamers," Bride said, silencing them. He stood at the double doors at the end of the mannequin-filled hall, his hands upon the door handles. All that was truly visible of him in the darkness was that tawny tousle of hair, his pale neck, and the light stripe down each of his gray jacket sleeves. It made him look a bit like a stick figure or a skeleton, the bare minimum required to appear human. As he pushed open the doors, warm light poured into the hallway. The space on the other side was as large as a gymnasium. The roof had collapsed long ago,
the golden evening found its way down through the jagged hole as a striving tree covered with creeper found its way up through it. The dust dazzled in the light. Everything smelled like real life, not one of 500 scents piped in.
Yes, Bride said, as if answering a question.
It was like a cathedral to ruination. Pigeons burst up from the shadows with a puff of sound. Ronan fell back in surprise. Hennessy threw a reflexive hand over her head. Bride didn't flinch, watching them vanish through the roof. Chainsaw threw herself after them with a joyful arc, 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 sounding enormous and menacing.
Balls, Ronan hissed, annoyed to have been startled.
Tits, added Hennessy. As they stepped farther in, another batch of birds burst from a pollen-coated carriage, knocking a mannequin onto its face.
See how it's become a museum to something entirely different, Bride said. Look how honest it is now.
Because of all the leaf litter and undergrowth, it was difficult to say what the exhibit had originally been, although an ivy-covered vintage fire truck a few yards away from the carriage suggested a street scene. Bride loved the memory of human effort.
How many years did it take for this to happen? Bride asked aloud. He laid his palm flat against the trunk of the big tree and gazed up through the split roof. How many years did this have to be untouched before a tree could grow again? How many more years will it take before this place disappears entirely? Will it ever? Or will a post-museum forever be a museum to humans? When we dream something, how long will it last? This is why we do not dream something absolute, something infinite. We are not so egotistical as to assume it will always be wanted or needed. We have to think of what will become of our dreams after we are gone. Our legacy.
Ronan's legacy was a destroyed Harvard dorm room, an invisible car, and a sword with the words "Vexed to Nightmare" etched on the hilt. Everything else he'd dreamt would fall asleep the moment he died. Hennessy froze. She froze so thoroughly that Ronan also froze, looking at her, and because he had frozen too, Bride eventually turned and assessed. He simply said, "Ah." Unhurried, he reached down into the underbrush by Hennessy's feet. He straightened, holding a black snake just behind its head. The snake's muscular body rippled subtly in his grip. Head cocked, Bride studied it. It studied him.
"It's cold for you, friend," he told it. "Is it not time for your sleep?" To Ronan and Hennessy, he said, "She is not the deadliest thing in this room. In the wild, this black snake will only live a decade or so, and the only thing she will hurt is just as many mice as she needs to stay alive. Elegant, efficient, wonderful, really. She is the in-out of a measured breath." He offered the snake to Hennessy. If there was any part of Hennessy that was afraid of the snake, she didn't show it. She simply took it, mimicking his hold behind its eyes. The snake twisted wildly, body undulating right by Hennessy's arm, and Hennessy's torso twisted too, bowing out of the way of the grasping tail. Then girl and snake seemed to reach an agreement, and they stood quietly in the undergrowth. "She's a fucking knockout. I would paint her," Hennessy said. "Look at her," Bride said. "Really look. Memorize her. What are the rules of her? If you were to dream her, what would you need to know?"
Ronan, high school dropout, had never been one for school, but he liked this. He liked all of it. He liked taking in the effortless, perfect way the hexagons of the snakeskin butted up against each other. He liked watching how the dry, cool skin seemed armored, inflexible, until she moved and it all contracted and expanded, the muscles moving beneath the surface like an entirely different creature lived beneath the skin. He liked being asked by a dreamer to think about her in the context of his dreams. Finally, Bride took the snake from Hennessy and released her carefully back into the underbrush. He said somewhat bitterly,
This is a museum to the waking. What would the artifacts of a world of dreamers look like? This is a civilization so sure of its own inadequacy and entitlement that it forever tries to drown out the din of other species with its own miserable white noise of failed ambition and masturbatory anxiety. A few voices cry out against it. What if those voices were the majority? What a world. Now, masks. Ronan withdrew his mask from his jacket. The two simple silken masks had been one of the first things they'd dreamt with Bride. Masks that made the wearer go instantly to sleep. Bride vastly preferred them to the dreamt sleeping pills Ronan had used before they met. Don't eat dreams, Bride had chastised him. At best, they'll starve you, and at worst, they'll control you. Dreams are like words. They're like thoughts. They always mean more than one thing. Are you sure those pills only made you sleep? Ronan's hands felt hot. His heart was beginning to pound. It had only taken a few weeks for the masks to generate a Pavlovian response in him. Bride swept his gaze over the ruined space. Let's find a safe place to dream. To dream. To dream urgently, purposefully. To dream with other dreamers. That enormous warm feeling was charging up inside Ronan again, big enough now that he could tell what it was. Belonging. 2. Hennessy dreamt of the lace. It was always the same dream. It was dark. She was meaningless in this dream. Not a cog in a machine. Not a blade of grass in a field. Possibly a speck of dust in the baleful eye of a loping beast blinked away, but nothing more. Slowly, the dream illuminated, and the light revealed the thing that had been there all along. A thing, an entity, a situation. Its edges were jagged and geometric, intricate and ragged. A snowflake beneath a microscope. It was enormous. Enormous, not like a storm or a planet, but enormous like grief or hatred. This was the lace. It was not really a thing one saw. It was a thing one felt. When Hennessy had first dreamt Jordan into being, Jordan slept curled up behind her. Her presence at once comforting and off-putting. Comforting because she was warm, familiar, entirely the same as Hennessy, but also off-putting because Hennessy, used to sleeping alone for 10 years, would startle awake as Jordan's breath just barely moved the hairs on the back of her neck. It's impossible to prepare for the creeping strangeness of having dreamt a copy into being. Hennessy didn't know what she owed Jordan beyond a body here in the waking realm. She didn't know whether she and Jordan were going to be best friends or rivals. She didn't know if Jordan might try to usurp Hennessy's life. She didn't know what to do if Jordan rejected it and struck off on her own. She didn't know what to do if Jordan embraced it and stayed with Hennessy forever and ever and ever. It was possible she might never be alone ever again, but she didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. That feeling, that was the lace. After Hennessy had first dreamt June, the second copy, she had padded down the hallway of her father's new suburban hole in the middle of the night, dragging her fingers across the wall because her mother had told her leaving oil on flat surfaces was a form of rebellion. And then suddenly she saw herself looming at the end of the hall. Impossible, she thought. I left Jordan in the room. And then she remembered June existed. But this was no comfort because there should have never been another one after Jordan. And what if June wasn't a direct copy, but rather a monster with Hennessy's face, and what if there was going to be another copy after her? And another one? And then Hennessy began to scream, and scream, and scream, and June started to scream, and scream, and scream, until Hennessy's father shouted from his room, "What in heaven's name? If she had a problem, come into the master and explain it to him, or quit raising the roof and let everyone sleep, for God's sake." That feeling, that was the lace. Sometimes, when Hennessy's mother, J.H. Hennessy, had still been alive, she'd put a mink brush in her daughter's hand and instruct her on how to move it over a canvas she'd already started work on. Hennessy would be full of the pride and terror that came from knowing she was making marks on a painting meant for high rollers and fancy shows. For minutes or hours, she and her mother would work in soundless partnership on the canvas, until it was difficult to tell which one of them had made which mark. Then her father, Bill Dower, would come home, and as soon as the door closed behind him, Jay would snap at Hennessy and snatch her brush back with enough force to tip pallets and spatter canvases. Mother, gone. Wife, arrived. Jay was two different people, and the changeover was dramatic. Hennessy, too, changed over from heart and mouth joy to confused shame in a moment. That feeling, that was the lace. Hennessy had spent a decade torn between loving and resenting her clones, fearing they would leave her, wishing they would stop needing her, and then Jordan had told her they'd all been shot in the fucking face by moderators, and she'd never see them again, so it became a moot point. That feeling, that was the lace. Huge, unavoidable, inevitable, exhausting. Hennessy, said Bride, just like that, the lace was gone. When Bride arrived in her dream, the lace always vanished. It was afraid of him. A neat trick. Hennessy wanted to know why. That's not important, Bride said. What do you feel? Since meeting Ronan and Bride, she'd spent more time than ever before wondering what it was like for other people to dream. She dreamt of the lace, always and forever. But most other dreamers had a different dream each night. Although she must have dreamt of something besides the lace at some point, she could neither remember nor imagine what that was like. She wondered how Ronan and Bride found her in dream space. They fell asleep, had their own dream, and then... Be present, Bride said. Stop wandering. How much power do you feel? A fuckload, Hennessy thought. Enough to dream something huge. Enough to bring the lace out in its entirety. Stop calling the lace, Bride said. I won't let it come back. I wasn't calling it. Bride smiled thinly. Other people revealed themselves when they smiled. Tough folks became teddy bears. Sentimental huggers revealed sharp-toothed gossips. Shy people showed goofy clowns. Class clowns turned out to be bitter depressants. But not Bride. He was an enigma before and an enigma after. Where is your voice? Be present. Now look. I've given you a canvas, and you've left it blank. Bride said, gesturing around them. Now that the lace was gone, the dream held just their conversation, nothing else. Laziness is the natural child of success. Who, after struggling up the ladder, feels like building another ladder? The view is already good. You're not trying. Why? Hennessy's voice was still just thought. There's a word for someone who tries the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Artist, suggested Bride. You didn't used to mind failure. She was annoyed that he was right.
Hennessy had spent her youth studying how pigment behaved, how badger bristles played paint versus squirrel versus hog versus Kolinsky sable, how complementary colors accentuated each other or canceled each other out, how the human skeleton was constructed beneath the skin, working on every flat surface that presented itself to her, trying, failing. She'd also spent an equal amount of time or more on training her mind. Perception and imagination were always the weakest link in any artist's chain. I saw what they wanted to see instead of what was truly there. Shadows became too dark. Angles went crooked. Shapes got elongated, crushed. The brain had to be taught to see without feeling, and then to put feeling back in. Fail, try again. Fail, try again. She couldn't remember how she'd ever had the bandwidth to do that for so many hours and days and weeks and years. This is better, Bride said. The dream had become a studio. Hennessy hadn't consciously thought of putting them in a studio, but dreams were crafty bastards that way. They gave you what you wanted, not what you said you wanted. The studio was as good as reality. It smelled wonderful and productive, earthy and chemical. Multiple easels displayed canvases in all sizes. Paint glistened on palettes. Brushes stood on handles like bristled bouquets. Drop cloths covered the old wood floor. Bride sat in a chair next to a wall of windows, his legs crossed casually, arm across the back of the chair. Jordan would have said he'd make a good portrait subject. The view beyond him was a city of historical buildings and close-set trees and invading highways. A distant storm mounted, the clouds tattered and checkered. The dream was trying hard, in the way that dreams do, to imply that Hennessy had been to the studio before, although she knew she hadn't. It's Jordan's studio, the dream said. If you don't recognize it, it's only because it's been too long since you've seen her. Why don't you keep up with her like you used to? Hennessy disagreed. She doesn't keep up with me. There you are. Found your voice, Bride said. You are not two things. You are not Hennessy asleep and Hennessy awake. You are more than the sum of your feelings, your id. You are also the things you have learned to do about them. Dreaming, waking, they're the same thing for you. When will you believe it? Put something on that canvas. The ley line is listening. Ask it for what you want. Hennessy stood before a canvas as tall as herself. In her hand was a brush, which was also a knife. She could picture the feeling of the blade piercing the canvas, the way the weave would shrink back from the wound. How splendidly and dramatically it would ruin the perfect flat expanse of the canvas. Let's have Hennessy the artist, Bride said sharply. The Hennessy who creates instead of destroys. What would she do if she could do anything? Jordan's the one you're talking about, Hennessy said. She's the artist. I'm the forger. There are not two of you. You need glasses, mate, Hennessy said. You were an artist before you made Jordan. But Hennessy couldn't remember that far back, not in a meaningful way. Fine, Bride said, annoyed. Show me what she would do right now. I assume she listens better. How would Jordan use this dream space? What if Hennessy were the dream, and Jordan were the one with all this incredible power and state? Art, Jordan had told Hennessy once, is bigger than reality. The knife disappeared. Hennessy was already painting
Beneath the brush's soft bristles was a rich stripe of gorgeous purple, a purple no human had ever seen before. Jordan would love it. Tyrian purple looked dowdy beside this color. Why hadn't Jordan tried harder to come with Hennessy on this latest adventure?
You know why, the dream snarled.
Jordan had taken off with Declan Lynch after mounting only the lamest of protests. She'd been waiting for an excuse to leave Hennessy for so long, and here it was. Outside, the storm grew closer, the edges of the clouds geometric and dark. Stay on task, Bride ordered. The purple paint on the canvas bled into the shape of lush purple lips. Hennessy's lips. No, Jordan's. Nearly the same, but different in important ways. Jordan's lips smiled. Hennessy's forged smiles from looking at other people's mouths. Carefully, Hennessy added a shadow, giving the lips dimension. The inky black was darker and truer than any black paint could be in waking life. Bride stood so fast he knocked the chair over.
Yes, yes, that.
This is what dreaming is for. Do not make a vegan copy of a burger. Eat a goddamn vegetable and love it.
Had Declan kissed Jordan?
Probably. Hennessy dipped her thumb in the pale feather pink on the palette, and then she swiped the pigment across the bottom lip. The highlight instantly rendered the mouth wet and full and anticipatory. It was more than real. It was super real. It wasn't just what lips looked like. It was what they felt like. It was image and memory and sensation all together in the way dreams could be.
Stop, Bride said. That's what you're bringing back. Experience it. Don't let it change. Ask the ley line to help you. It can. He broke off, and his expression went far away. Hennessy suddenly thought, out of nowhere, wheels.
Wheels?
Bride shouted, Ronan Lynch, stop that!
She just had time to feel something a little like all the air going out of the room, which was funny because she hadn't been thinking about breathing in the dream. Then everything disappeared.
3.
Hennessy awoke with a start. She was moving. She was not just moving. She was moving fast. It was like a movie. She saw herself from above, looking down, God gazing down on his creation. A slender black girl with a fro full of debris tumbled ass over tits over ass again down hundreds of neatly stacked hay bales in an old barn. Her rag doll body was bizarrely caged in something that looked like an enormous wooden hamster wheel. It was rare that the waking world made less sense than the dreaming one. But the bigger picture didn't become clear until she careened all the way to the barn floor, breath busting from her paralyzed body. The bigger picture was this. Wheels, wheels, wheels. The thing she thought looked like a hamster wheel around her was a tangle of actual wheels. It was just one of many that filled the barn. There were muscular tractor wheels, fragile bicycle wheels, little toy wheels, man-sized wooden carriage wheels, child-sized plastic steering wheels, spokes dangled from rafters. Rims wedged between hay bales. They ramped over mannequins and up against the doors. Every wheel had a single word printed or burned into it. Tamquam. It looked like an art installation. A prank. Insanity. It was breaking Hennessy's brain. One part of her mind whispered, "This is how it's always been. The wheels were always here." The other part, however, knew better. This was how it always worked when she saw other dreamers' dreams manifest. They didn't just magically appear. Instead, the dream magic edited her memory. Not completely, just enough to create two realities. One where the dreams had always been there, and one where they hadn't. Brain-breaking.
"Ronan," Bride's voice sounded irritated. A delicate light hissed into existence, revealing Bride halfway up the towering stack of old hay bales. The dreamer's exploration of the Living History Museum had turned up three decent possibilities for dreaming locations. A small diorama recreating the close sleeping quarters of a submarine, a single four-poster bed in a recreation of some historical figure's bedroom, and this, a large recreation of an old hay barn. So realistic that it seemed likely it had probably already existed on the property pre-museum. Bride climbed down the hay bales, complaining as he did, "Aren't you tired of doing this?" Because this wasn't the first time Ronan had trashed a place since they'd begun traveling with Bride. He'd filled a through hiking shelter with bleeding rocks, destroyed the living room of an abandoned rambler with a very small tornado, busted out the wall of a cheap cash-only motel with an invisible car. He'd trashed rooms with dead earthworms and hissing microphones, school textbooks and expired bacon. Every zip code they'd stayed in had been left with Ronan Lynch's indelible mark. Hennessy had to admit a small, rubbishy part of her was glad for all of this, because as long as Ronan Lynch, the great Ronan Lynch, was fucking up at this level, it made Hennessy's inability to kick the lace from her dreams not quite as damning. "Hennessy, are you awake?" Bride asked the air. Hennessy couldn't yet reply or move. Dreamers always did this after a successful dream. They saw their temporarily paralyzed bodies from above for a few minutes. She was still getting used to the idea that this paralysis didn't have to be synonymous with shame. Before all this, it had always meant she'd made another copy of herself. It had meant failure. Now, even though she couldn't see what she'd brought back from the dream, she was sure at least it wasn't another Jordan Hennessy. No more copies. Ever. She'd never been so long without any of her girls before. "Jordan. Jordan."
The world shouts at you. The waking world. The dreaming world. You don't have to listen to it, but you do. And until you learn to shout louder than it, we're going to keep having this happen. Bride had uncovered Ronan from beneath a pile of hay bales and wheels like the prize in the bottom of a cereal box. His star pupil was just as paralyzed as Hennessy, so Ronan couldn't escape the lecture as Bride went on. "I expect better from you. How long did it take us to find a place with this much power in the bank? And what did you write a check for? This. This shit. Did you give half a thought to any other dreamer while you were doing this? No, you just ran your mouth, and out this came."
And Hennessy was back. She could feel her body again, and she was looking at the world through her own eyes. Shouldering off her cage of wheels, she searched the hay around her, looking for whatever object she had brought back from her dream. The painting, the brush, the palette, something. But all she found was hay and wheels and yet more hay.
Bride was still going, and what a way to die, suffocated under rotting food for cows that don't exist anymore. The Grey Warren, isn't that what your Forest Lindenmere calls you? Dreamer and protector. Dreamer
and protector and fool with lungs full of silage if I hadn't been here. For what?
I was trying, Ronan finally snarled.
So was Hennessy, and you took it from her, Bride said.
Man, that little rubbishy part of Hennessy was having a field day.
Did you manage to find your painting, Hennessy?
The haystack has not produced a needle thus far, she said.
Bride flicked his eyes around the barn. Dreams could sometimes end up quite far away from their dreamer, especially when they were big. But there was no sign of any of the large things from the dream, like a canvas or the chair he'd been sitting on. Then she spotted it. On her thumb, there was the faintest smear of feather pink paint, the same pink she'd smeared across the canvas in the dream. This was what she'd been paralyzed for, just a mere scraping of dried pigment. She supposed Jordan would have been delighted to see it. It wasn't a dreamt copy of Hennessy, and it wasn't the lace. Technically, that was huge progress, even if it didn't feel like it. Sometimes, as Ronan had just demonstrated, it was as much about what you didn't dream as what you did. She showed her thumb to Bride as if she were hitchhiking. Found it.
Bride rounded on Ronan again. So you pulled the lay right out from beneath her. What a gentleman. How much is left now? What do you feel?
Ronan looked like a cat doused with water.
Right, you can't. I forgot, Bride went on. The fairy tales we tell ourselves are so comforting in times of darkness. I'll tell you how much. Very little. The ley line bent over backward for a barn full of wheels going nowhere. And if the